Welcome to today's reading of the Midland Reporter Telegram and the Odessa American, read by volunteers and staff. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
This is Dave, and I'm reading from the Midland Reporter Telegram, Tuesday, September 14th. This is Section A, the front page. The headline reads, County approves $2.4 million for Midland Memorial Hospital. County's contribution to hospital matches donation made by the city. By Caitlin Randall. The Midland County Commissioners Court on Monday approved allocating $2.4 million in American Rescue Plan Act funds for Midland Memorial Hospital to use on contract staff and incentive pay for current employees. The allocation was half of what the hospital needs, according to CEO and President Russell Myers. The Midland City Council approved providing the other half at a city council meeting in August. The total, $4.8 million, from the county and city will be used for three purposes, Myers said. First, the hospital will give a 3% bonus to all MMH employees below the department director level because employees did not receive raises last year. Additionally, the funds will cover incentive pay for employees working overtime to care for COVID-19 patients and the extra costs of bringing in contract staff during the latest virus surge. The Commissioner's Court approved the money for the hospital in a 3-to-1 vote, with Commissioner Robin Donnelly casting the dissenting vote and Commissioner Scott Ramsey abstaining because his wife is on MMH's Board of Trustees. Robin Donnelly said he was voting against the item because the county had already budgeted the $34 million it received in ARPA funds for a project to bring city water to county residents on well water. He also criticized city council members for approving half of the hospital's request and asking the county to fulfill the other half. I'm very concerned that the city council would push another taxing entity to us to determine their funding, Donnelly said. He added that it was disconcerting the council made that decision without first consulting the county about the budget. Donnelly also said he was opposed to approving the request because the county's reserves were depleted to $26 million during the pandemic, which he said is less than a quarter of the county's budget. Dr. Richard Bartlett, a family doctor in Odessa, spoke against the hospital item during Monday's meeting. He said MMH is not doing enough to promote early treatment for COVID-19, like the Regeneron antibody treatment, and implied that the hospital might be overpaying respiratory therapists. I think I might need to change my career to a respiratory therapist after I heard the ridiculous amount of money you're paying, he said. Bartlett also criticized MMH for not using the inhaled budesonide treatment he's touted in media interviews as a silver bullet. Hospital officials have previously said there is not enough data to suggest it's an effective treatment. Despite Bartlett and Donnelly's objections, the Commissioner's Court approved the funds for MMH effective October 1st. This article is entitled, NRC OKs Spent Nuclear Fuel Storage. Company has said it plans to expand the Andrews facility. By Stuart Doreen. The Nuclear Regulatory Commission reported Monday that it has issued a license to Interim Storage Partners, LLC, to construct and operate a consolidated interim storage facility for spent nuclear fuel in Andrews. The license authorizes the company to receive, possess, transfer, and store up to 5,000 metric tons of spent fuel and 231.3 metric tons of greater than Class C low-level radioactive waste for 40 years, according to an NRC release. The company has said it plans to expand the facility in 7 additional phases, up to a total capacity of 40,000 metric tons of fuel. Each expansion would require a license amendment with additional NRC safety and environmental reviews. Interim Storage Partners is a joint venture of Waste Control Specialist LLC and Orano USA. ISP intends to construct the storage facility on property adjacent to the WCS low-level radioactive waste disposal site already operating under a Texas license. Information about the license application and the NRC staff's reviews is available on the NRC website, according to the news release. The licensing documents will be available on this page as well. The NRC's announcement Monday came days after Texas Governor Greg Abbott signed legislation to ban high-level nuclear waste from the state of Texas. Odessa Republican Brooks Landgraf was the author of House Bill 7, which was filed in response to an effort to bring the nation's high-level radioactive waste to a low-level radioactive material disposal facility in Andrews County. Landgraf, in a statement, offered the following about the NRC's issuing of the license. The Biden administration, through the NRC, would cause a violation of Texas law if their license results in the storage or disposal of spent nuclear fuel or any other high-level radioactive waste. I expect that the state of Texas will deploy our available resources to enforce our laws. Prior to the passage of HB 7, the state of Texas had no leg to stand on if it became necessary to fight back against the Biden administration. HB 7 is our weapon against high-level waste. The spent fuel and waste must be stored in canisters and cask systems, the NRC stated. The canisters and cask systems must meet NRC standards for protection against leakage, radiation dose rates, and criticality under normal and accident conditions. The canisters are required to be sealed when they arrive at the facility and remain sealed during on-site handling and storage activities. The NRC's review of the license application included a technical safety and security review, an environmental impact review, and adjudication before an Atomic Safety and Licensing Board. A safety evaluation report documenting the technical review is being issued along with the license, the NRC reported. A final environmental impact statement was published in July. The environmental study included extensive public input during its development and during the comment phase. The adjudication resolved contentions filed by several local and national petitioners. This is the second license issued by the NRC for a consolidated storage facility for spent nuclear fuel, according to the NRC. The first, private fuel storage, was issued in 2006, but the facility was never constructed. The agency is currently reviewing an application from Haltech International for a similar facility proposed for Lee County, New Mexico. A decision on that application is currently expected in January 2022. This article is entitled MMH, Urgency for Vaccinations Still High, by Stuart Doreen. Midland health officials said Monday there is still a great need for Midland County residents to get vaccinated, and they hope the mass vaccination clinic opening today at West Campus will be well used. The comments came as the number of COVID inpatients inside Midland Memorial Hospital fell to 82 on Monday morning, down from 93 on Friday, and down from a pandemic high of 125 a couple of weeks ago. Not only are hospitalizations down, but so is the positivity rate at Midland Health testing centers. Midland Health reports the positivity rate last week went down for the fourth straight week, finishing at 23.3%, the lowest percentage since late July. The Midland Health Department also reported Monday that the number of new cases continues to decline. From August 22nd to 28th, there were 1,328 cases reported. Preliminary numbers show that total fell to 982 on August 29th to September 4th. Latest numbers from the health department show an 18.7% decrease on September 5th to the 8th, week over week. Still, Stephen Bowerman, Chief Operating Officer for Midland Health, stated Monday that while hospital officials are grateful for any reprieve, the numbers show a significant presence of COVID in the community. Those numbers include the 982 cases 2 weeks ago were still the third most during this spike. The 23.3% positivity rate is still more than four times the rate around July 4th. The percentage of eligible residents inside Midland County that are fully vaccinated is 43.1%. The percent of those 65 and older that are fully vaccinated is 68.2%. There were 5 COVID-related deaths this past weekend and 17 so far in September. Lastly, 82 COVID patients at MMH is not a light load. We're not downplaying the urgency for vaccinations on our end, Bowerman said. Whether people hear that we were at 125 a few weeks ago and we're at 82 today, and they don't need the vaccine, I sure hope not. But we're going to continue to push it and continue to have these press conferences often and share the numbers that we're experiencing and encourage people to get the vaccine. So I hope that the slight decline we've been experiencing in the hospital does not turn people away from getting the vaccine. The vaccination clinic will welcome those looking for a first or second vaccine or a booster shot at the F. Marie Hall Outpatient Center. Bowerman said at this time, Pfizer is the only vaccine they are providing as the hospital attempts to rebuild its inventory of Moderna vaccine. He recommended that people talk to their physicians if they don't know if they are eligible for a booster at this time. Call 2214-VAX or go to midlandhealth.org/schedulemyvaccine this week. Afternoons Tuesday through Thursday. I would expect we would run the clinic as long as there is a need, Bowerman said. This is the local page. This article is entitled City Council to Vote on Property Tax Hike by Stuart Doreen. The Midland City Council will vote Tuesday on an increase in the tax rate, which is expected to raise the city's share of the total tax bill on the average home in Midland by $82. The city reported in agenda documents that it will seek approval of a proposed property tax rate of 36.7189 cents per $100 evaluation for the fiscal year 2021-22 operating budget. The money raised from the tax rate is expected to generate approximately $63,192,505, which is less than half of the budgeted appropriation of $137.666 million for the fiscal year. The city currently shows a tax rate of 35.8928 cents. On an average homestead, $272,361, according to Midland Central Appraisal District, that translates to a tax bill of $978. Should the council approve the 2.3% increase in the tax rate, that combined with an increase in the average homestead taxable value to $288,698 would lead to a $1,060 tax bill, an increase of 8.43%. The city also shows the general fund budget for fiscal year 2022 would increase by $2.655 million. Of that amount, $1.448 million is tax revenue to be raised from new property added to the tax rolls this year. During a budget workshop in July, city leaders heard that sales tax revenue is projected at $51 million next year, or around 37% of the budget at that time. Other sources of revenue include franchise fees, 11%, court fines and fees, 1.5%, ambulance fees, 2.1%, and licenses, permits, and other, 3.6%. City officials noted that the 63 $1.192 million in property taxes does not pay for police and fire department budgets, around $69.7 million combined, as reported in July. City leaders previously said the increase over last year is expected to help pay for personnel and new equipment for the new animal services facility, $227,703, a new fire ambulance, $300,000, engineering positions, vehicles and equipment, $340,239, a new municipal court tech manager, $81,187, and more. Other highlights previously reported include police department and fire budgets are ranked first and second in terms of impact on the budget, $35.203 million and $34.533 million, respectively. Engineering is third at $21.452 million, or 16% of the budget. The only other department at or above 10% of general fund expenditures is community services, 10% or $13.107 million. City leaders learned that their fund balance or savings could grow to $83 million at the end of fiscal year 2021. City leaders told staff they want that fund balance around 35% of the budget or around $48 million. City staff said that there are $31 million to be allocated on capital projects, and there is another $4 million in available funds for city leaders to use on other items that come up, or discretionary funds. A 2% salary increase for sworn and non-sworn city employees, $100,000 allocated for downtown events, oil and gas revenue moved into a Parks Special Revenue Fund. That could include up to a combined $5 million from fiscal year 2021 and fiscal year 2022. $1.165 million in facility improvements at multiple locations. 9 new firefighter positions. This article is entitled PBAF Serving as Fiscal Sponsor for Hogan Park by Mella McEwen. Efforts to redevelop Hogan Park continue to move forward thanks to a promotional agreement between the Midland Development Corporation and the Permian Basin Area Foundation. At Monday's monthly MDC board meeting, board members approved the promotional agreement whereby the foundation will serve as the fiscal sponsor during the fundraising phase of the Hogan Park redevelopment. Under the agreement, MDC will cover the foundation's 2% administrative fees for donations received. MDC will pay the foundation $60,000 per quarter so that the entirety of funds raised for Hogan Park go directly to its redevelopment. It's estimated the fiscal sponsorship will last a year or less, obligating MDC to $240,000 total. Serving as the fiscal sponsor for a project of this scale requires significant administrative work and staff time on the part of PBAF, MDC Executive Director Sarah Harris explained to the Reporter Telegram by email. She continued, As discussed in previous MDC board meetings, the redevelopment of Hogan Park will increase sports tournaments, sports-related tourism, and hotel and retail spending from visitors to Midland. Parks and public spaces catalyze economic activity. Excluding the golf course, Hogan Park currently draws approximately 360,000 visitors per year, of whom an estimated 45% are out-of-town guests. After redevelopment, Hogan Park's annual visitor capacity will grow to 1.2 million. Harris also reported that Midland representatives, including the MDC, recently visited the Career Technical Education High School that is under construction in Hobbs, New Mexico, to view project progress and learn about the programs that will be offered there. She also reported that Representative Chip Roy, Republican, Texas, will visit Midland Spaceport Business Park on October 6th. This article is entitled, Sheriff, MCSO jailer was fired before arrest for Capitol riots. By Caitlin Randall. A former Midland County jailer charged last week in connection to the riots at the U.S. Capitol building was employed with the sheriff's office for 4 months, according to Sheriff David Kreiner. Kreiner told the Reporter Telegram on Monday that Corey Ray Brannon worked as a jailer at the Midland County Detention Center from April 6th to August 24th, when his position was terminated. He declined to say why Brannon was fired, but said it was not connected to the FBI's investigation into the Capitol riots. Brannon was arrested on September 7th and charged with 4 misdemeanors, including entering restricted grounds and disorderly conduct in a restricted building. The charges are punishable by a total of up to 3 years in prison. Photos and security footage allegedly show Brannon inside the Capitol building after climbing through a window, according to an arrest affidavit. This is the coronavirus page. This article is entitled, Midland Memorial Hospital Not Making Decisions on Employee Vaccines Now, by Stuart Doreen. Midland health officials said Monday they will not make any strong decisions on the direction we must take until we have really clear guidance on what the expectations will be. This stance followed discussions with employees over the weekend. Last week, President Joe Biden made a sweeping vaccination mandate which led Midland health leaders to say that it appeared all employees will now be required to be vaccinated. Midland Health CEO Russell Myers said on Friday that about 72% of Midland Health staff is fully vaccinated. On Monday, Chief Operations Officer Stephen Bowerman said that Midland Memorial Hospital falls in the category of having to enforce that mandate as a facility that accepts Medicare and Medicaid money. However, he said that Midland Health will not make decisions off the president's press conferences, but wait for clear regulatory guidance on what the actual requirements are and what exemptions may look like. Bowerman repeated what Meyer said last week, that those regulations are expected in October. So for now, we're not making any strong decisions on the direction we must take until we have really clear guidance on what the expectations will be, Bowerman said. This is the obituary column, Tuesday, September 14th. Benita Ann Bustamante. Benita Ann Bustamante, aged 42, of Odessa, passed away unexpectedly on Sunday, September 5th. The viewing will be on Friday, September 17th, from 12 to 9 p.m. at Nellie Picklin Wells Funeral Home. A memorial service will be held in her honor on Saturday, September 18th at 11 a.m. at Nellie Picklin Wells Funeral Home Chapel. Benita was born September 25th, 1978 in Abilene, Texas, to Helen Olivares. Benita is survived by her parents, Helen Olivares Martinez and Pete Salas Martinez of Midland, her brother Pete Martinez Jr. and wife April Martinez of Gardendale, brother Robert Martinez, also of Gardendale. She is also survived by her sons, Gennaro Jacob Ayala of Midland, Anthony Ayala Martinez of Midland, Christopher Bueno Ayala of Lubbock, and Cesario Ray Ayala, and Isaac Regino Reggio Ayala, both of Midland. Benita is survived by her boyfriend, Gilbert Luna Jr. of Odessa. She's also survived by many loving nieces, nephews, and uncles and cousins. Arrangements are under the direction of Nellie Picklin Wells Funeral Home and Crematory of Midland. Online condolences may be made at www.npwelch.com. Janie Mae Pattison Baker. Janie Mae Pattison Baker, our mama, passed away Saturday, September 11th, 2021. She was born in San Angelo, Texas, to C.E. Pattison Sr. and Myrtle Pattison McClure, September 28, 1928. She grew up in Midland, then moved to Odessa with her husband and children in 1956. She is survived by her husband, William Dean Baker, and her children, Phyllis Mangam, Richard, William Dean Jr. Zula, and Chris Baker, her brother Phil McClure, Elspeth, 5 grandchildren, 6 great-grandchildren, and numerous nieces and nephews. She was preceded in death by her parents, brothers Hugh McClure and C.E. Patterson Jr., son Greg Baker, and great-niece Kelsey Logan. Death Notices. Arthur Lee Connor III. Arthur Lee Connor III, 78, of Odessa, passed away on September 4th. He is survived by 2 children, Arthur Lee Connor IV, Stacy, and Kimberly K. Hively. There are no services planned at this time. Christopher Michael Souter. Christopher Michael Souter, 33, of Midland, passed away September 8th. The family will receive guests from 6 to 8 p.m. Thursday, September 16th, at the branch at NPW. Funeral services will be held at 1 p.m. Friday, September 17th, at First Baptist Church Chapel. Arrangements are under the direction of Nally Pickle and Welch Funeral Home and Crematory of Midland. Online condolences may be made at www.npwelch.com. Kathleen Mary Stratton. Kathleen Mary Stratton, 62, of Midland, passed away on September 3rd. She is survived by her spouse, Reuben Flores, 3 sons, Andrew Flores, Anthony Flores, and Robert Stratton, and 2 sisters. There are no services planned at this time. Tanya Lynn Gentry. Tanya Lynn Gentry, 66, of Midland, passed away on Thursday, September 9th. Funeral service will be held on Thursday, September 16th at 11 a.m. at Nally Pickle and Welch Chapel. Arrangements are under the direction of Nally Pickle and Welch Funeral Home and Crematory of Midland. Online condolences can be made at www.npwelch.com.
Hi, I'm Kim, reading the Odessa American. It is Tuesday, September 14th, 2021. Vaccine mandate not in force yet. Hospitals wait for guidance on Biden's marching orders. Rumors and miscommunication from as far up as the White House have left confusion on if and when President Joe Biden's mandate that health workers must be vaccinated if they work at health facilities that participate in Medicare and Medicaid will begin. The topic was addressed during Monday's COVID Zoom call with local health providers who are already dealing with a crisis in staffing as the most recent COVID surge continues to suck away at resources. Last week, Biden laid out a plan that will require full vaccinations for workers who are employed at hospitals, home health agencies, and other types of medical facilities that get the funding. He also said companies that employ more than 100 people must require vaccines. Biden's orders have caused an uproar, with some GOP members speaking out, as well as state officials in Texas. MCH CEO Russell Tippin said the hospital is looking for Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services guidance to come down before October and is also making resources and education available for any staff member that wants to get vaccinated. There are so many rumors and miscommunications from the White House about what is going on, especially in the great state of Texas. There are legal situations out there, and we've to see what that looks like. Tippin said a decision on mandating vaccines for MCH workers will come only from the elected board and only after they have thoroughly studied the issue. COVID has strained the budgets of all hospitals, not only with COVID patients, but also with shutdowns in elective surgeries that typically provide a strong revenue stream. Tippin said there are religious and other situations that can exist for vaccine exemptions, and that all of those things must be considered. But, he said, MCH cannot afford to lose staffing to this mandate or to other factors such as career changes or even those just wanting to work somewhere where there is not a vaccine mandate. We can't afford anything that handicaps us from moving forward. In New York, one hospital has quit delivering babies because their whole staff quit after refusing to take the vaccine. We are bringing in travelers, traveling Medicare staff daily. MCH has a staff vaccination rate of about 62%, and Odessa Regional Medical Center is about the same. On Monday, Tippin said there was 98 COVID patients at MCH with 3 in pediatrics. He said 24 were on ventilators and that 20 of the 24 are not vaccinated. He said most COVID patients at MCH are from Odessa and are ages 17 to 88. He reported the Regeneron clinic at MCH was going well and that it averages 60 to 80 people a day. There have been 3 deaths at MCH since last Thursday. ORMC CEO Stacy Brown said 28 patients are at ORMC with 6 on ventilators and that about 45% of the patients are age 50 or below. Most are from Odessa. ORMC Chief of Staff Dr. Rohith Saravanan said it remains unknown if the area has seen the peak of this surge. We had a slight increase over the weekend in the community. Pay attention and be careful. The rest of the country is seeing it level off. Keep masks on and encourage people to get the vaccine. Both Brown and Tippin said they encourage the vaccines, but following a mandate for vaccines is for either elected board members at MCH or ORMC corporate folks to decide. In other COVID news, reminder that the urgent care on 42nd Street near Permian High School, Westside Urgent Cares, U.S. Representative August Pfluger issued a press release calling on Governor Greg Abbott to push back against the mandate, saying Biden's mandates are a flagrant overreach of his presidential power. Pfluger said he is vaccinated and supports those seeking the vaccine, but that citizens have the right to make the decision for themselves and not to be forced into taking a vaccine. Tippin sent a letter to MCH staff last week regarding the likely coming mandate. The letter: I first wanted to start this message off with a heartfelt thank you. Thank you for what you have done for the past 18 months. Thank you for your unwavering spirit in the face of darkness. And thank you for your commitment to making sure our patients, COVID or not, receive the highest level of care possible during their stay at Medical Center Hospital. COVID-19 has forced this hospital, this community, and this country into many unwanted and unprecedented situations and decisions, including lockdowns, surgery shutdowns, mask mandates, ethical decisions regarding care, and now possible vaccination mandates. We are aware of the White House's mandate announcement this Thursday, which will require all healthcare workers at facilities that receive funds from Medicare and Medicaid to be fully vaccinated. Under this mandate, it will not allow healthcare workers to opt out of the vaccine and instead receive mandatory weekly testing of COVID-19. While we highly encourage all of our employees to be vaccinated against COVID-19, more than 60% are fully vaccinated. This is not a decision that we want to be forced upon our employees by federal leadership. We want our employees to be able to make that decision for themselves. As a healthcare facility that receives Medicare and Medicaid funding, not complying with this mandate would put us in a dire financial situation. However, we want you to know that we will be exhausting all of our resources to determine how to approach the situation, and a final decision has not been made by hospital leadership and the Ector County Hospital District's Board of Directors. We are already in the process of consulting with legal experts as well as local, state, and federal agencies to determine our rights and abilities under this federal mandate. We also want you to know that we will communicate with you during this process and will make sure you are informed along the way and when a final decision has been made. We truly don't know a time frame on an ultimate decision. While the White House wants this mandate to go into effect immediately, there will ultimately be legal battles and lawsuits that could make it all the way to the Supreme Court. Instead of overreacting, we want to approach this situation calmly and deliberately. This will allow us time to immerse ourselves in what will assuredly be a fluid situation of new information, legal battles, and personal rights. We understand that this mandate would affect roughly 40% of our employees, and if forced upon, we know that we would inevitably lose a valuable portion of our staff. a loss that would be unimaginable in our current shorthanded situation. During this uncertain time, we are asking you, the very people that make this hospital function on a daily basis, to remain calm and unwavering. We are asking you to not make any rash judgments and or social media posts regarding your future at MCH based on this federal mandate. While we explore all of our potential options, we need each and every one of you today and every day. You have put this community on your back for the last 18 months and have carried us through some of the darkest days this country has ever seen. You are always in my prayers and in my heart, and I pray for guidance in this situation as we move forward in the fight against COVID-19. God bless. Russell R. Tippin, MCHS President and CEO. Pianos incorporated into blended learning. Along with traditional subjects, Noel Elementary School is giving students a chance to tickle the ivories through blended learning stations. Blended learning is a teaching model tailored to individual students, where students learn based on their own gifts and gaps. It leverages individual student data and focuses on growth. The district website said, Noel Principal Jeannie Chavez said they incorporated enrichment labs to give students a chance to find different interests. Music teacher Chris Munoz decided to try pianos out. The 16 instruments arrived in August, and he hopes another 5 will arrive soon from Milam Elementary, the fine arts magnet. He also incorporated blended learning in music in his regular music classes, Chavez said. There are stations just like in the classroom and 45-minute blocks to sit at the piano. I really give children a different way to learn from all those different stations, Munoz said. On a recent Thursday, he was teaching students about the grand staff using different approaches. And so we're talking about the grand staff at each one of these stations and in different ways. The hope is that one of those ways is the way the kid really is able to grasp the concept, Munoz said. Chavez said Munoz started from the basics, such as how to sit at the instrument and where your hands go on the keys. I've come in at the beginning of the year where he's starting off with the basics and the foundation of just how to sit correctly, and to this date he has a student who can play an entire song, she added. Chavez said the program gives students chances they might not get normally. Most of the kids have never seen a piano before, Munoz said. I probably was one of those corners in previous lives. But actually sitting down and playing at a piano, this is the first time these kids have experienced it, and also in our district. Right now, Noel Elementary, besides Milam, is the only campus that has a piano lab. So it is a great opportunity for students at Noel Elementary. Chavez said parents are excited as well. We've posted some pictures on social media with our Facebook and things like that. The kids, of course, go home and talk about it, and the parents are really excited. Just the comments that they've posted, the feedback that we've gotten from parents, they're really excited, Chavez said. He, Munoz, was telling me today how students love to come to music. He felt like he's always competed against PE. You know how the kids love to go to PE. Now they love to come to music, so it's great, she added. Noel has about 436 students in grades 3 through 5. This is Munoz's 4th year at the campus. His previous experience working with professional orchestras gave him the idea to try piano stations. I worked with different piano competitions, the Van Cleburne International Piano Competition in Fort Worth, and just seeing how the piano is able to spark such interest. And of course, you start looking at the SAT grades, things like that, and they're just amazing when the student has played piano in their life. So he thought it was something that should be added. One of my main goals here is that every student, hopefully, will continue in fine arts when they go on to middle school, Munoz said. A third grader who learned the first complete song has been an inspiration to the other students. Now they want extra time to learn pieces. Everyone wants to be the second one, Munoz said. Chavez said Munoz has a routine for students before they sit down, where they sanitize their hands, for example. They understand how special it is. I've told them that we're one of the only campuses in Odessa that has this. So they all want to treat the pianos properly. They want to make sure that they're here for a long, long time for future generations. So they're taking their own pride in that. Every time we're done, they're turning off the pianos. They're closing the lid. No drinks or anything are allowed in this area. They're all following the rules, Munoz said. Chavez and Munoz has an honor choir, which not all elementary campuses do. Munoz said he's hoping to have a full recital, something in the spring, and bring in a real piano into the cafeteria or gym, like a baby grand. He said students are currently using mini or digital pianos. They are hoping the COVID numbers come down so the performance can be live, although Munoz has live streamed them. Chavez said she has noticed the difference blended learning and the pianos have made in academics. They like that personalization. And then they also like that we've incorporated enrichment labs, and they have that rotation in their schedule where in the morning they have a turn to come to a different enrichment lab. It's not the same one. They know the routine now. They're going to do the enrichment lab first thing in the morning, and they're going to go to class, and they're going to concentrate on the academic content area. So it has helped them have the release and be more focused, Chavez said. The piano. Chavez said she's also gotten drawn into the classes during walkthroughs. She has learned about musical notes and musical staffs. Walkthroughs are supposed to be like 5 to 10 minutes. Not even 10 minutes, but I'm distracted in his classroom because you're learning. I don't remember learning that much music before, Chavez said. Counts are likely to up garbage, water, and sewer rates. The Odessa City Council is expected to approve a 2.5% rate increase, or a combined total of $1.93 more per month for water, sewer, and garbage customers during their today's council meeting. Council briefly discussed the proposed rate increases during their September 7th work session and voiced no objections. Assistant City Manager of Administrative Affairs Cindy Muncy last week told council that the rate increases are needed to cover inflation, equipment costs, and an increase in employee salaries. Mayor Javier Joven emphasized the rate increase will not be used to repay a $95 million certification of obligation that council in August approved to pay for the rehabilitation of the city water treatment plant. The average Odessa household will see a 52-cent increase in their monthly solid waste bills, Muncy said. Residents who live in apartments or mobile homes will see a 27-cent increase. Small businesses will see a $2 per month increase. The average household will see their sewer rates increase by 53 cents per month, and residences who use 2,000 gallons or less per month will see their bills go up by 32 cents per month, Muncy said. Water users will also see a 2.5% increase in their bills, with users of 5,000 gallons per month seeing their bills go up by $1.92, and rates for residences who use 2,000 gallons will increase by $1.32. Qualifying senior citizens 65 years or older will pay $1 per 2,000 gallons. Council is also scheduled to consider the possible vote to approve the allocation of $10,161,479.50 in American Rescue Plan Act funds. Representatives from Medical Center Hospital and Odessa Regional Medical Center have made separate pleas to council requesting American Recovery Plan Act funds. Hospital officials said the funds are needed to help them hire more nursing staff to care for COVID-19 patients. MCH is requesting $4 million, ORMC, $2,592,000. MCH President and CEO Russell Tippin said MCH is struggling with a severe nursing shortage at a time when COVID numbers have increased locally. His concerns are echoed by ORMC President Stacy Brown. Tippin and Brown said they are literally competing for nurses in hospitals around the world. It's put quite a strain on our facility, Brown said. If we can't get any more help within the next 2 weeks, we will have to cut back on the number of COVID patients we can take. Councilman Steve Thompson has said he supports the funding request because the city would be reimbursed by the federal government. Tippin told council he made a similar request to county commissioners, but the county has not yet acted on that request. Council will also consider a request from the University of Texas of the Permian Basin for a $430,000 so the school can purchase and install new athletic equipment for their sports park. City Manager Michael Marrero is recommending that if council decides to approve the request, the $430,000 would come from the city's hotel occupancy tax fund. The council could also use general operating dollars, he previously said. UTPB recently allowed several local sports associations that have been using the university's sports fields for years to remove equipment and even building structures that the sports teams had purchased over the years. The sports groups decided to relocate after UTPB and city's long-term contract expired on August 31st. Leaders from the sports associations refused to sign new contracts with the university. The proposed new contracts would have required the sports teams to pay a small fee to continue to use the school's facilities, submit an annual financial audit, and give the university oversight of the use of their own fields. Several city council members said last week they support giving UTPB the funds because the city does not have a park in the east part of Odessa. UTPB officials said they intend to make the park and its facilities available to the public. County to consider new property tax rate. Ector County Commissioners will consider and propose a 2021-22 property tax rate during their Tuesday Commissioners meeting. Commissioners have not yet indicated what the tax might be. County Auditor Randy Donner said on Monday, they will discuss and propose a tax rate on Tuesday and then vote to adopt it at their September 28th meeting, Donner said. The county's current tax rate is 0.365000, according to the Ector County budget for fiscal year 2020-21. Precinct 1 Commissioner Mike Gardner said on Monday that commissioners are expected to propose and keep the same rate as 2021-22. The average yearly property tax paid by Ector County residents amounts to about 1.91% of their yearly income, according to the website www.tax-rates.org, which compiles tax information from county tax assessors' offices throughout the U.S. Ector County is ranked 1,521st out of 3,143 Texas counties for property taxes as a percent of median income. The commission will also consider increasing the starting pay for nurses, according to the commissioner's court agenda. A national nursing shortage due to COVID-19 has caused fierce competition for attracting new nurses, local health officials have said. Commissioners may also vote to adopt a new policy granting paid quarantine leave for peace officers and detention officers employed by the county. Commissioners are also expected to discuss a request to periodically schedule future commission meetings in the evening so that more residents can attend. The commissioner's court currently meets at 10 a.m. on every second and fourth Tuesday. COVID-19 news. By the numbers, COVID in the basin. Ector County, 23,027 total cases, 443 deaths. Midland County, 23,620 total cases, 309 deaths. Texas, 3,823,937 total cases, 60,202 deaths. U.S. cases, 40,870,648 total confirmed and 656,318 deaths. Find out more at covidinthebasin.com or the CDC site at tinyurl.com/TZTRJLF. Quick Hits Donation Barrels. The Oil and Gas Workers Association is in need of relief from Hurricane Ida, in particular Louisiana and the Gulf Coast region. The Medical Center Health System has set up donation barrels outside of the MCHS cafeteria, as well as outside of the MCHS Urgent Cares on West University Boulevard and JBS Parkway. Donation items requested include bottled water, diapers, and non-perishable food items, canned goods. The Oil and Gas Workers Association will then take the donated items and goods directly to those affected in Louisiana and the Gulf Coast region. Online outreach program. The LNOL Art Museum will participate in the National Youth Summit on Gender Equity, an online outreach program organized by the Smithsonian's National Museum of American History in partnership with Smithsonian Affiliation from September 21st to October 12th. Designed for middle and high school students across the country, this year's topic will allow youth to examine gender equity and efforts to fight against gender bias. Two live events are scheduled for September 21st, 1 p.m. to 4 p.m. Eastern Time, and October 12th, 1 p.m. to 3 p.m. Eastern Time. Teachers may register the classrooms for the webcast and to access free supplementary education material for all ages at http://americanhistory.si.edu/NYS. Teachers may also facilitate their own youth summits anytime between September 21st and October 12th, using learning resources and video provided, free to all registered educators. The LNOL Art Museum is one of 12 Smithsonian-affiliated organizations hosting regional youth summits with local activists, scholars, and youth. In addition, the LNOL Art Museum has chosen to focus on confronting gender bias in sports and its regional youth summit, moderated by Anna Martinez-Katzen, UTPB Professor of History, will take place virtually the night of September 23rd. This free regional youth summit is open to middle and high school students ages 14 to 18. Participation size will be limited, and interested students are encouraged to register before September 15th. Participating students will also be given a completion certificate and a Zine kit. For more information, contact Annie Stanley at education@noelartmuseum.org or 550-9696, extension 213. Registration deadline. To be eligible to vote in the constitutional amendment election of November 2nd, you must be a registered voter. If you are not a registered voter or if you need to update your address with a voter registrar, you have until October 4th to do so in person, or application must be postmarked October 4th. You may also submit an application online with the Secretary of State at the following email addresses: Ector County at http://www.co.ector.tx.us/default. ASPX?Ector_county/elections. Midland County at www.co.midland.tx.us/elections. Secretary of State, www.sos.state.tx.us. For voting status, call the election offices. For Ector County Office, 1010 East 8th Street, Suite 101, Ector County Annex, 432-498-4030, or Midland County Office, 2110 A Street, Midland County Annex, Midland, 432-688-4890. National Night Out. The Odessa Police Department would like to remind the public to sign up for this year's National Night Out, which is scheduled for 6 p.m. to 8 p.m. October 5th. The deadline to sign up is 5 p.m. October 1st. Email the completed registration form to mhamilton at odessa odessaamerican.tx.gov or mail it to 205 North Grant, Odessa, Texas, 79761. You can also drop it off anytime at the OPD front desk. National Night Out is designated to heighten crime and drug prevention awareness, generate support for and participation in local anti-crime partnerships, and send a message to criminals letting them know that neighborhoods are organized in fighting back. In 2008, the National Association of Town Watch, NATW, officially agreed to have a National Night Out for Texas on the first Tuesday of October instead of the traditional first week of August. Board to hear reports and hire associate superintendent. An evaluation of opportunity culture, a report on campus improvement plans, and the hiring of an associate superintendent on the agenda for Ector County ISD Board of Trustees workshop today. The meeting is set for 6 p.m. in the first floor boardroom of the administration building, 802 North Sam Houston Avenue. According to supplemental agenda material, ECISD chose to implement opportunity culture to provide equitable access to excellent instruction for all students, recruit and retain excellent teachers, provide all teachers with excellent development and advanced career opportunities. Campuses were selected by leader readiness. Principals that lead this work on campus must have the ability to think innovatively about staffing and classroom composition. School need. Schools that have traditionally struggled with staffing are considered a prime candidate for the innovative staffing models opportunity culture employs. Student performance. Areas of the district that would receive the biggest impact by increasing the time students learn from effective teachers are priority. The 2020-21 group of campuses were Blackshear, E.K. Downing, Sam Houston and Ross Elementary Schools, Crockett and Wilson and Young Middle Schools, and Odessa High School. The 2021-22 group includes Burnett, Dowling, Fly, Goliad, LBJ, Noel, and Pease Elementary Schools, Bonham and Bowie Middle Schools, and Permian High School. Texas Tech University evaluated the data. On a separate item, the board will consider hiring an associate superintendent. That person will take the place of Stephanie Howard, who was deputy superintendent. Howard is now superintendent of Crane ISD. Early release day this week. Ector County ISD students will have an early release from school on Wednesday as district staff members will spend the afternoon in professional development and planning. This is the first of five early release days in the ECISD calendar for the 2021-22 school year. It is important to note that three schools do not follow this early release schedule. Odessa Collegiate Academy and OC Techs, which are aligned with the Odessa College calendar and observe these days on different dates, and Ector College Prep Academy, ECISD's in-district charter partner, which does not use early release days. The dismissal times for early release are as follows. Buses will run their regular after-school routes based on these times. Noel Elementary and Travis Elementary, 11:30 a.m. All other elementary campuses, 11:40 a.m. Carver EEC and Lamar EEC, noon. Odessa Collegiate Academy and OC Techs, 12:20 p.m., September 17th. Middle schools, 12:50 p.m., does not include Ector Middle School. Odessa High School, 1:35 p.m. New Tech Odessa and Premium High School, 1:40 p.m. ECISD's academic calendars can be found at www.ectorcountyisd.org under the calendar tab at the top of the page.
We've been reading from the Midland Reporter Telegram and the Odessa American. Please stay tuned for the weather, followed by the second hour's reading of the newspapers.